All right, well, welcome to our Church of Christ the King Sunday School class. We're continuing this morning our study in the book of Ecclesiastes. And so if you go ahead and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 8, we're going to be looking at chapter 5, verse 8, and try to get all the way through chapter 6, verse 9 this morning. So I'm going to introduce the class with a poem. Okay, it's actually music. Okay, so this is really for Douglas and the rest of us. Okay, those of you who like music. So this song was written in 1955 by a man by the name of Joe Hayes, and it's based on wisdom or advice that was given to him by his mom. It's been covered probably, I don't know, 50, 60 more times. So you may not know it, but it is. In certain corners of the United States, it's known. It's called The Satisfied Mind. So how many times have you heard someone say, I'm looking at Doug to see if he knows the song or not. No?
It's been a while.
All right. How many times have you heard someone say, if I had his money, I could do it my way, do things my way. But little they know that it's so hard to find one rich man in 10 with a satisfied mind. Once I was winning in fortune and fame, everything that I dreamed for to get a start in life's game. Then suddenly it happened, I lost every dime, but I'm richer by far with a satisfied mind. Money can't buy back your youth when you're old, or a friend when you're lonely, or a love when it's grown cold. The wealthiest person is a pauper at times compared to the man with a satisfied mind. When life is ended and my time has run out, my friends and my loved ones will leave, there's no doubt. But there's one thing for certain: when it comes my time, I'll leave this old world with a satisfied mind. So that's our topic today, contentment. And one of the things that we've been talking about now for the last two classes, and this is the third one on this broad topic of greed and contentment, this issue of what is the Christian's disposition or attitude towards wealth, towards money, and towards those things that are possessions, okay? Things that are often strived for and oftentimes treated as an idol. In fact, Colossians 3:5 specifically says, right at the end of the verse, Paul says, greed, comma, which is idolatry, right? So we saw this in last lesson in chapter 5, 1 to 7, this idea, this focus on our relationship with God and how greed can destroy it, okay? When a person doesn't tithe, right, and this the context of last week's lesson was the context of temple worship and the person committing to give a particular sacrifice and then reneging on that gift, okay? And approaching worship as if, you know, not to listen but to talk, right? It's like it's their opinion that matters when they show up to worship and not God's opinion, all right? So you can see how a person whose covetousness and greed can destroy their relationship with God. It can be a real impediment and something that's really damaging. So that's what we looked at in the previous class. And then two classes ago, we started this topic and we saw oppression and how the oppression of people is oftentimes a result of greed and people who are desiring the possessions and the things of other people and they end up oppressing them seriously. And we're going to revisit that that theme in the first two verses today. We also saw how greed and covetousness can rob you of the joy in life. So it's really damaging to a person's ability to enjoy the gifts that God has given. And even if you do obtain riches, they're fleeting, right? So there's a vapidness to wealth, and it's a thing that even if you do obtain some high level of wealth, there's no certainty there. It's a very shifty, you know, it's like building your house upon sand. Okay, there's this danger. It's the expectations that people often have when it comes to wealth are certainly just not there. So that was 2 weeks ago. And so today, what we're going to look at, same topic, okay? And that has to do with money and possessions and contentment. And there's going to be a very strong section of application. So the antidote to greed is contentment. And so, and specifically, contentment with an understanding that God is sovereign over your place in life. And there is a sovereignty of God that is connected to everything that goes on in your life. And those things together, okay, so when we say contentment, I'm not talking about someone who's just lazy, right? And just has no view of God and just has no, you know, just sits around, does nothing. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about contentment that is godly contentment, okay, biblical contentment. And so we're going to take a look at that. And there's a lot to pragmatic. Once again, this is a lesson that is given by the author who identifies himself as the teacher. Okay, and we have a young student, and so that's the context of the lesson today. And so, and as is often done when you're teaching a young person, and this works for us as well as older people, is that you tend to use a lot of very concrete illustrations. And that's really the best way to communicate an idea, is to start with something concrete, a story, right? You know, a story here, a story there. And then you move to the more metaphorical, right? You don't start in the metaphorical and expect the young person to just automatically jump to the concrete, okay? And this is something that's true. It's helpful for adults as well, but especially with children, you know, using illustrations and stories and, you know, is really a very effective way of teaching. And of course, Solomon is a master teacher. So let's take a look. Verse 8. Let's see. So the first topic here is revisiting oppression. And it's almost like that Solomon is expecting you to remember the lesson from two classes ago. Okay. When you do this. So he says this: if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. So what's happening here is a young person is seeing, perhaps for the first time, a denial of justice and mistreatment of the poor. So it's the oppression that we saw in the previous chapter, but it's specifically related to authority, okay? And it's not uncommon, it's very common actually, for young men in particular to be really upset by this, like really vexed, okay? And it's, you know, I mean, who joins the Communist Party, okay, or becomes a fascist, or you know, maybe they go, you know, go instead of going to the left, they go hard right, right on the political spectrum. It tends to be young people who are seeing this sort of thing and just being very vexed about it. Okay, so what's the application? Interestingly enough, well, don't be shocked, right? Okay. A fool or a person without experience, a young person in particular, will be shocked. A wise person, someone who's been around a while, realizes, okay, that that's actually not shocking. It may not be good. He doesn't say, oh, just normalize it and pretend like it's a good thing. He doesn't say that. He says, don't be shocked, okay? When you see those sorts of things going on, you know, these power structures within a society, and there's abuse that happens because of those power structures, you need to realize there's some, you know, you need to realize that there's a reason for it. And we've already had a lesson on that, right? Right? Why is there oppression? Because there's these people who want to obtain to extract the wealth out of other people. Okay? And in this case, in this example, the king who's is cultivating the land, okay? It's good for the land. The land's producing more food than it would have if this king had not been there to exact authority and to exercise power, okay? Now, he's not doing it in a way that the young man agrees with, right? He's denying justice and he's oppressing the poor. But nonetheless, the land is actually benefiting from it. You see the nuance there? So we don't necessarily like everything that happens in our government today, okay? But let me tell you, it's better than anarchy. And I've had that, by the way, I have young people in my life, okay? And this is not my first conversation on this topic, okay? All right? You know, so when I hear things like, all politicians are corrupt, I'm like, really? No nuance in that statement? Really? Every single one of our senators takes bribes? Everyone? Really? You think so? You think that's really the way it works? That's an ignorant statement. It is. Because it's not true. It's not true that every single one does it. That's just a blanket kind of ignorant statement. Some probably do. Some don't. Right? And there's a lot of complexity in power dynamics. And what you see on the outset as an outsider is very rarely what's really going on. It could be a whole lot worse than what you see, or it could be completely, much less worse than what you're imagining. Okay, so the greatest example of this, right, in history is actually a pretty crazy story. So what happened in 1914. So on June 28th, 1914, there was this young man, okay? He was 19 years old. His name was Gavrilo Princip, okay? And he was a hot-headed Serbian nationalist. And he's doing what all hot-headed nationalists do, right? Antifa folks, you know, leftists, maybe some rightists, okay? And that is they drink coffee in the morning because they're not busy enough, right? So he's at a coffee house sipping coffee, okay? And he looks at the newspaper, and his friends, like his other hot-headed friend, right, the other young guy, says, hey, did you know Archduke Ferdinand from Austria is touring our city today? He goes, really? He said, yeah, that's what it says right here in the newspaper. So I had no idea. And all of a sudden, he heard this commotion outside the cafe. And he walks out, and there's the Archduke Ferdinand in his broken-down car stuck in front of the cafe. And the mechanic, the driver, it's not a mechanic, the driver is like trying to get it to work. And Ferdinand's sitting there with his wife, who's Serbian, and they're sitting there, and I'm sure they're kind of fiddling and trying to figure out what's going on. And this hothead, guess what? Well, he had a pistol in his coat. So what did he do? He shoots him dead. Exactly. Shoots him dead. And those are the first shots of World War I. Okay? Was there a grand cabal, a grand conspiracy? No. It was one hot-headed 19-year-old, okay, drinking coffee and who was opportunistic. So in this day and age, what would we get if that were to happen again? You'd have emails in your inbox. You'd have all kinds of conspiracies out there, right? It would be this and that and this and that and this and that. Solomon's simply saying, you know, don't be surprised. These kinds of things are going to happen. Okay, don't jump to these absurd conclusions. Maybe you're right, maybe you're not, right? But be wise when it comes to this sort of thing. And when you see it happen, all right, don't act as if you necessarily know everything about it. Okay, this is the kind of thing that is going to exist. It's always going to exist. So, let's go ahead and move on because. This is, you know, these first two verses are in some way harking back to the oppression section. And it's almost like Solomon is kind of making application to the previous discussion on oppression of the poor or those in power, those who are not in power by those who are in power. So let's take a look at verse 10. And now we're going to move into the topic of money and contentment, okay? And he's going to move around approach this subject in a few different ways. You're going to notice a lot of proverbs that are meant to be easy to remember, okay? And this is a good one. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. Okay, so what is vanity? Okay, vanity is the unmet expectations. The person who is thinking that that money is going to bring a satisfied mind. Okay, money is going to bring contentment. If I can just have a little more, I will find contentment, right? But the reality is, right, there's no point in time where money actually delivers on contentment. It just doesn't. I mean, that's the reason in our vernacular, we use terms like rat race, okay? I mean, that's the whole point of that term, rat race, is that everyone's trying to earn a dollar, right, in the rat race, okay? But at the end of the day, is it really, you know, there's this vanity to the effort, right? It's like everyone has to do it, but at the end of the day, you feel a little bit dirty doing it, right? Like rats. Or we call it the treadmill. You're on the treadmill, right? Once again, right? You're working, 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 but it's like, you know, the path never ends, right? So, you know, that's something that I think a lot of people, not only young people, but even older people, you know, have this misguided concept that that money can bring contentment, and it just doesn't. Verse 11, it says, when good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owner except to look at them? Okay, you know, you can only eat one meal at a time. So if you had 10 meals, well, you can only eat one, right? Right, if you have, I mean, you see this, and I use a lot of car illustrations because that's something I'm interested in. But you see this when people's car collections get really large, okay? You know, the utility of the automobile goes down the more you own, right? So you own one car, and maybe it's a really good car. You like it. You enjoy it. And it'll get you from A to B. That's got lots of utility, a lot of value in your life. You own two cars. Well, man, you can only drive one at a time. Right? Three cars, four cars. Now you got this collection of cars, okay, and most of them are sitting and getting dusty, okay, because you can only drive one car at a time. So what's the value? Well, the utility used to be I could drive from point A to point B, but now the value, the utility is I can only look at it. It's really dropped down. So what's his point? His point is you're not going to find contentment, okay, by simply increasing the goods. Right. If you own one good Ferrari and you get in that and you enjoy it and you're driving fast and or whatever you do with Ferraris. Right. And you enjoy that car. Right. You're going to get a ton of pleasure out of that car. But if you own every Ferrari from, you know, 1970 to today and all the colors, or maybe they're just all red. OK, well, guess what? You know, are you going to get, you know, if you have one Ferrari and you own 10, are you going to get 10 times the pleasure? 10 times the contentment? The answer is no, right? The answer is no, right? You actually don't. It's diminishing returns, and you don't ultimately find it. You know, you don't ultimately find it, right? You eat a nice steak meal once a year, okay? You enjoy that meal. What if you had steak every night? I'm telling you, the joy you get out of that one steak meal once a year, like let's just say you could only afford a steak once a year. Would you be looking for that, looking forward to that time all year long? Hope's like, no. You not like steak?
I love steak.
Oh, okay.
But if you have it all the time, you don't.
Yes, 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 exactly. But if you're eating it every day, right, you know, there's nothing to look forward to. It's, you know, the whole excitement goes away. So, and that's just the nature of things. Right. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. Right. In other words, there's this relationship between the increasing of goods and the desire to own them. But at the same time, the value is going down. So you have this increase of goods and the decrease of utility. Verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. So once again, the young man is thinking, oh, my purpose in life is to get wealthy. That's going to give me happiness. And Solomon is like, no, don't think that. Don't think that. The more good you have, the more you have to lose. Okay? You've got all your gold and Solomon would know, right? If there's anyone who knows this, it's the kings, it's the politicians, it's the people who have power. Right. And how fleeting it is and how it doesn't give you contentment to have lots of goods that are at risk. OK. right? If you, you know, if you have a, if, you know, you lose $1 billion overnight because your hedge fund crashed on you, are you going to sleep very well? Everyone's like, "Oh, I never thought of that before," right? Right? No, you won't, right? You won't, right? I mean, you may not sleep at all, right? I mean, it's really, you know, the loss of goods is really stressful, and it's not the recipe for contentment and joy in life. Okay. Verse 13 says, "There's a so we're moving on to a slightly different topic, but there is a or angle to the topic." So he says, "There's a grievous evil," so illustration here, "which I've seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded to their owner, by their owner to his hurt." Well, that's interesting. Now, he doesn't tell us how the person is hurt, but there's something going on here, and there's lots of answers to this particular illustration where a person can hoard wealth and end up being hurt by that. But he says, so however that happens, when those riches were lost through a bad investment and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. So here's the deal with riches, is that you, the wealthier you get, the greater your opportunity, your chance for disappointment and pain and suffering. Okay? I mean, that's just true. Right? If you were a young person and you grew up in a little house, right? I grew up in a little house made, you know, made by the Japanese in the 40s, okay? You know, it was not a big home, right? I still love parquet floors, okay? I don't see them very often, but when they're around, okay, because they're this old-timey thing. But let's just say, but, you know, growing up like that myself, I, you know, my expectations for living, you know, weren't really that high. Okay. You know, I mean, I mean, we talked about buying a mobile home when we first got married, right? It just didn't dawn on me that maybe there's people who wouldn't want to do that. I'm serious. Like, it didn't cross my mind that there are people, right, who would never in their right mind even contemplate living in a mobile home. God forbid, right? Am I right? Am I, you know, I'm not the expert here. I'm coming from a little bit different angle, right? But the reality is that there is risk. There is this risk of loss, and it's pretty high, right? I mean, it actually happens quite a bit. People lose, you know, their wealth, and their children end up in poverty or just, you know what? They don't even have to be in poverty, right? You can have someone who's extremely wealthy, right? Say they've got $1 billion and their kids are multimillionaires, and people will still scoff at their kids, right? And it's not because they're poor, right? It's because they've suffered loss. Okay. So that's not, you know, that's another risk that's associated with wealth. And so don't think once again that wealth is going to just grant you contentment and happiness. Okay. Verse 15. As he had come naked from his mother's womb, so will he return as he came. He will take nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hands. Okay, this is the whole, we in English today, we say there's no luggage racks on hearses, right? Is it a hearse or a hearse?
Hearse.
No
T.
Okay. So a hearse, okay? There's no luggage rack on a hearse, okay? You can't carry it to the grave. So this also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a man is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him if he's toiling for the wind? Well, that's a good question. What is the advantage, right? And once again, we've already answered this question. Okay, we spent several weeks answering the question of what is the advantage to work? What can you get out of work? What should you expect out of work? That was one of our main questions from earlier on. Okay. And then verse 17 is a summary statement, I think, of all people who spend their lives in pursuit of wealth and are greedy, I should say, greedy or covetous people. Here are the great kind of a summary statement of what can happen, okay, and what can be the result of a person who's living like that. Says throughout his life, Okay, and this is just the person who's gained a lot of wealth and then dies, right? Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness. Okay, so darkness in Ecclesiastes is often associated with the fool, right? The fool is the one who walks in darkness. Okay, so he's eating in darkness. He's got his food, but he's got his goods. He's got his house, his car, his yacht, you know, this. But he's enjoying those things or doing those things, okay, in a way that a fool does, okay? Exercising those things, utilizing that money, those goods in a foolish way. And he does it with great vexation, okay? There's this idea that what you expected out of money didn't deliver. I thought that if I made my first million, I would be happy, right? I'll be finally ready to move on with my life, right? Sorry, David, I can't serve the church, okay? I'm too busy, and when I make my first million, David, I'll come back with you and fill out that form, right? I've got too much, right? And you know what? That's what God would want from me, right, David? God would want me to be secure, financial freedom, right? I need financial freedom before I can serve God, right? Hope the answer is no, just in case. I don't want anyone to be fooled here. Okay, answer is no. No. No, you don't have to be financially, quote, free to serve God. That's ridiculous, okay? Because what you're getting instead is vexation. You're getting that first million, you're going to get that first million. And guess what? It's not going to be enough. You're not going to come to David. You'll never fill the form out, right? You'll never serve God, right? If that's the attitude, you just won't. I can guarantee you, right? Unless you have some major turn of heart and repentance and confessing that sin, right? It won't happen. That's not the path to doing that. Okay, what about sickness? Yeah, it's just not a healthy way to live, right? So, I mean, stress, anxiety, I mean, it's sickly, right? It's not good for you health, you know, just from a pure physical standpoint. And then finally, anger. Wow. Yeah, I mean, you wonder why there's so much road rage. You know, I think a lot of it isn't because of the driving. Right. It's because people are angry already and you cut them off. Right. They're not road raging you because you cut them off. They're road raging because they already have all this anger. Right. And perhaps in some cases, the anger comes from this. It's so common. Right. People are thinking if they can just get ahead and make this money. And they get the starter house and then they go to the bigger house and they get maybe they have a wife, maybe have some kids or maybe a trophy wife later on. But they've got this plan, right, where they're moving around, right, and doing this and doing that. And it's not giving them what they're looking for. Right. And it's an angering thing, you know, for men in particular. But women can get angry too, right? When they think that, you know, their goal is one thing, and those things are, and that contentment they were expecting is unmet, right? I'll get married, and I'll live happily ever after, right? I've seen Disney. That's what happens, right? No. Okay, I'll get a dog. No, that's not enough. Oh, I'll have kids, right? That'll just give me happiness. No. Didn't quite work that way, right? That you're not going to, you know, ultimate contentment, ultimate fulfillment, right? It doesn't come from those things, you know, inherently.
It's an expectation that you can earn somewhere where you're going to arrive and finally...
Thank you. That's a great word. I should have said that. Arrived. Thank you. Yeah, in our culture, that's exactly the word we use. So-and-so has arrived, right? Yeah, they've arrived, right? Yeah. All right. Yeah, thanks, Allison. So verse 18, we've got, so it's interesting. Solomon is going to put the application here, all right, right in the middle of this section. So there's more to come after this section here, but he's going to essentially place the antidote to greed and covetousness right here. And we've talked about it before in previous class, so this isn't brand new. Verse 18. Here's what I've seen to be good and fitting. Okay? To eat, to drink, enjoy oneself and one's labor in which you toil. So like loving your work to the best of your ability. If you can love your work, enjoy your work, I should say, then you know that's a good thing under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. Okay, so he's, once again, we did talk about, he is emphasizing, you know, that there's a time element here. Notice he says, God has given, for this is his reward, right? That's it. And this is the answer to the question we posed in previous classes. And that is, what can you expect, right? What advantage is there? What can you get out of your work, right? And the answer is, enjoy it. Receive it with thankfulness. Furthermore, as for every man to whom, once again, God has given riches and wealth, he, God, right, has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God. So we're not talking about hedonism here. This is not the pursuit of pleasure for the sake of the pursuit of pleasure. This is enjoying the gift of God, recognizing that God is sovereign, and they're all, and every opportunity you have to enjoy the goodness that is God has provided in your life is a gift from God. And so all good things must be received with thankfulness. And this is the antidote to greed. And it's this, I shouldn't call it a secret. I mean, my goodness, it's in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's been around a while. Right? There's other places in the Bible as well. This isn't the only place. So it's not a secret, okay? It's only that so many people don't understand it. They don't understand that contentment and the antidote to living a life full of vexation and anger and darkness is the joyful reception of all good things that God gives you, right? Which includes your work, right? Andrew, you've got a great job now, and, you know, you're thankful, right? You know, you're thankful. But our attitude towards our jobs, right? I like my job, too. But my attitude towards my job is you know, I'm not employed because, you know, I just deserve it. Like, that's not the only reason, right, that I have a job. God's protected me in my job. He made it possible. He's given me the knowledge, skills, and ability to do the job. I mean, there are so many cases, you know, in my career where I could have lost my job. It doesn't take much to lose a job, right? It only takes one upset supervisor, okay, or vindictive person, or, you know, there's lots and lots of reasons. And you may lose your job, and I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily, you know, something you can't recover from. All I'm saying is that though when you do have those things, and you do have the ability to enjoy a meal and to get a paycheck and to do those good things, recognizing that it's, you know, that it's ultimately under, you know, it's God's gift. Okay, it's the gift of God, right? So many people who are wealthy are just downright arrogant, right? It's just the truth. You know, they think they did it because of their own, you know, smarts and their own, you know, intelligence. And sure, oftentimes they are very intelligent, you know, but oftentimes they're very lucky. They're in the right place at the right time. That's the only difference.
Well, and where does that intelligence come from?
Where does the intelligence come from? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, on the flip side, there's people who are really poor who have the same attitude, by the way. Okay. You know, taking pride in being in their poverty, right? For different reasons, but you know, pride and not recognizing God as the source of all good things. That's not you know something that only wealthy people have. It's across the board. But we're talking here specifically about money and riches and possessions. Okay, so verse 20. Notice this statement here: for he will not often consider the years of his life. Okay. All right, that's contentment. That's where we're getting the whole concept of contentment, okay? Because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of heart. So this is a person who's content. He is not vexed, okay? He's not constantly worried about the future, constantly worried about where the next meal is going to come from, constantly worried, like worry, 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 right? As if you are sovereign over it, okay? You know, I mean, you're not, right? None of us are sovereign over our next meal and sovereign over our job. I may think I'm doing the best job I can do at work and doing a great, fine job and come in with a layoff notice next week, right? It's possible, right? It can happen. But even though that's true, my attitude towards work, my attitude towards life should not be one of worry. And a person who is trusting in God and really believing in the sovereignty of God, okay, those worries are going to diminish. They really are. I mean, that's one of the beauties, right? And then this is the conversation kind of going back a little bit is, you know, what is true freedom? Is true freedom really $1 million, or is true freedom saying that's in God's hands? Right. And is, you know, which one's true freedom? Is it, you know, having a large bank account, or is it placing your trust in God over your financial well-being? Where is true freedom found? Where is peace found? Where is contentment found? I mean, this is the topic. This is really what we're talking about. Okay. And the answer is, it's in God. It's a gift of God. Every good thing is a gift of God, to be received with thankfulness. Okay. So what is true thankfulness? True thankfulness is recognizing, okay, who the giver is, right? This is why thank offerings are so important. I mean, even today, you know, we're not under the law of Moses, but we have this concept played out for us or given to us in the law of Moses, the concept of a thank offering, right? And a thank offering is a real important idea. So it's not a tithe. So a tithe is a temple tax, but a thank offering is your way of worshiping God, right? Through thankfulness and taking what he has given to you and giving it back to him. So it's not the temple tax. It's a way of worship. It's application of this here. God's given you this, and you're like, you know, I'm going to take a portion of it and I'm going to say thank you. How do you say thank you? It's called a thank offering. That's how you say thank you. Okay? Does everyone understand that idea? Yeah, you can pray and say thank you, God. I'm not saying that's not possible. But are you really thankful? Right? I mean, what's the best way to be thankful? What's the best way to demonstrate to God and to the audience that's watching? Okay, the angels. Right? They're watching. Okay, what's the best way to say thankful and to recognize that things came from God? It's to take a portion and give it back. Right? When you do that, you're saying to everyone who's watching, okay, in the heavenlies and to God, what you are communicating is, this is from you. It's not my doing. I'm not sovereign over this bonus I got, okay, at work. Right? That, you know, sure, I worked for it. Sure. I'm not saying that there's no relationship. All I'm saying is that it's the goodness of God that you received the bonus at work, okay? It really is, right? And giving a thank offering is your way of saying to God, demonstrating to God, and demonstrating to the audience who's watching when they are, right? And this is not like audience in time. This is audience throughout eternity, throughout all time. It's a big audience, okay? You're demonstrating to that. It's a worship. It's glorifying to God. You're bringing glory to God through that activity. So, people oftentimes they use money as their identity, right? And that's another real danger. And maybe we won't go into that too far, but oftentimes people connect their wealth to their identity. You know, I'm a millionaire or billionaire, or I'm a this or that or whatever, right? Right. Or a country boy can, you know, survive. Right. Hank Williams Jr. Right. That's on the other flip of the coin. OK. Right. I don't need money. Right. I can live off the land, right? So it's the same sort of attitude, just on the flip side. But your identity, okay, you know, shouldn't be, and this is a struggle, I think, in our world, because we're taught this almost every moment of every day, right? Okay, that your identity is based on your consumption, what you wear, what you buy, you know, the kind of car you drive, the kind of house you live in. That's what we're taught. You're being taught that, okay, constantly. But that's not where our identity should be. Our identity is in Christ, right? And the one that we serve and the one we're going to ultimately give account to and see in eternity. All right. Chapter 6, verse 1. And what we're going to do is we're going to move through this relatively quickly, but there's five more reasons that are given in these nine verses for why contentment, right, and our attitude towards wealth and riches should be one of contentment and thankfulness rather than one of greed and covetousness. So let's begin with an illustration. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God has not empowered him to eat from them. A foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. So once again, we have an illustration of a person who does obtain wealth and honor. He has everything he needs, but he loses it, right? It says a foreigner enjoys them. So this is so we had a bad investment in the previous illustration. Now we've got it basically being stolen, okay? So someone stole the goods, okay? And what is the vanity in this situation? The vanity, right, are the expectations that are not fulfilled. A person in this illustration here has stored up everything that they needed, put it in their barns, okay? And they're like, it's time to retire, time to party, right? You know the parable. And God's like, you fool, right? Was it the wealth that this guy in the parable stored up that was the problem? Actually, it wasn't, was it? So in the parable, the man earns or is very successful. He has huge crops, okay? And instead of turning to God in thankfulness and worship, he instead hoards them for himself and says, I'm set. I don't need God anymore, right? I don't need God anymore. So that's what's going on in the parable. And I think in this story as well is what happens when a person has that attitude. Wow, it's a severe affliction. It's vain in the sense of, you know, that attitude, a person who has that attitude is going to really suffer. Verse 3 says, if a man fathers, it's another illustration. So if a man fathers 100 children, lives many years. Okay, this is long life. A lot of people, you know, they're putting their faith or their trust or their hope, I should say, maybe in something not quite as obvious as money, but it's, you know, long life, health, you know, lots of kids. Said, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than he. For he comes in futility and goes into obscurity. Okay, talking about the miscarriage. And its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, and it never knows anything. Right? That miscarriage is better off than the person who lives, you know, hundreds of years, has lots and lots of children, and yet doesn't have contentment, doesn't have a satisfied mind, right? And you might think, wow, really? Say, yeah, it's true. You know, you can live hundreds of years, maybe 100 years, okay? But if it's full of vexation, you know, and anger and greed, I mean, you're better off of just, you know, not had that time. Okay, that's wasted time, right? It's time that has no value. It's a sad and a sad place to be. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice over, right, and does not enjoy the things, do they not go to the same place? Yeah. And we talked about this in a previous class on the certainty of death, so I'm not going to revisit that theme. Verse 3, it is better to have not lived than to live an uncontented life, right? Notice that having lots of children, living a long time, right, is no guarantee of contentment. Yeah, that's something I didn't say. So I do think that we can think that you'll be contented, right, and you'll find, you know, you'll have quote arrived once you've lived a long time, or if you obtain that milestone. But that's just not the case, right? It's not a bad thing, of course. It's a good thing to live a long life, but it's not going to carry, you know, the expectations that are placed on it. All right, verse 7. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. Okay, a proverb here. Okay, and this goes back to some things we said earlier, that contentment cannot simply be found simply by getting more, right? You know, what's the application here? Rather than looking for more, you know, once again, enjoy the gifts of God. So my brother and I have been touring barbecue joints in Fort Worth, and we've done the best ones, right? We've hit the top barbecue joints in Fort Worth, and some really good barbecue, actually, here. Really good barbecue. And I've enjoyed the food, but my enjoyment really is spending time with my brother. And the truth of the matter is, I've had some pretty bad barbecue before that, and still enjoyed myself, right? So let me tell you, the best barbecue in the world is the barbecue that's right in front of you. The best hamburger in Fort Worth is the one that's in front of you, okay? Not this one over there, okay? It's the one in front of you, even if I overcook it, right? And it's a little dry, okay? There's ketchup, there's mustard, okay? You can deal with it, okay? All right? But that hamburger is in front of you right now, okay? I ate hamburgers every day this week. We had leftovers. And so I've eaten
up. I was out of town.
And Karen was out of town. So I have hamburger on the mind. But you know, even though I ate it for lunch every day, I enjoyed it every single time. It's amazing what chips and mustard can do. You know, but I had to make an effort, right? You know, truth be told, to eat leftovers. Sometimes you do. So this is an important principle. I mean, the foodies out there, those of you who like food and like trying new things, I mean, don't get me wrong. I enjoy, you know, new stuff and trying new food, and that's all wonderful. But don't forget, right, that you're never going to be content. You're never going to find, like, the perfect burger. You'll never find the perfect barbecue. Like, you'll never get to a point where you're like, ugh, this is the best barbecue in Texas, right? It's like 5 minutes from my brother's house. We went there. And it was really good, but let me tell you, I didn't reach barbecue nirvana, okay? Right? It just didn't happen. Like the lights didn't come on, and right? And I just felt a serene sense of peace come over me when I ate the best barbecue in Texas. It didn't happen. It was good, but once again, it's not going to ultimately, you know, give you some sort of finality, right, in satisfaction or contentment. Verse 8. Okay, so verse 8 is an interesting one because it's time for kind of a pop quiz, okay? He's got two rhetorical questions, but the answers are in chapter 2. So I think he's expecting you to know the answer, at least if you've studied the book and are familiar with it. He says, for what advantage does a wise man have over a fool? Okay, question mark. And then another one, what advantage does a poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? And the answer is in chapter 2, verse 14. That is, the wise man has eyes in his head, and the fool walks in darkness, okay? So we have someone who has an advantage, okay? And that is that they have eyes in their head. They can actually see where they're going, okay? So there's something about living wisely and what we've been talking about today that gives you a right perspective on the future and a right perspective over the pitfalls and the dangers and the, you know, the consumerism and how do you avoid it and what are all the different things you can trip up in life. The advantage that the wise man has is that he knows where he's going. Okay. And he's not going to make He's not going to trip. And then finally, or the second question, is what does a poor man have, advantage a poor man have, knowing how to walk before the living? So the idea of poor man here is the person who doesn't have the advantage of wealth. Okay, so that's what he means by poor man here. So he's saying, okay, you don't have all the advantages of wealth. So what advantage do you get knowing how to live, knowing the practical side of wise living? Like the practical part, right? Knowing how to walk before the living, right? And the answer is, once again, the fool, the wise man has eyes in his head, and the fool walks in darkness, okay? And this goes back to verse 17, where it says he's eating in darkness, right? The fool is eating in darkness. The wise man is not eating in darkness, okay? So it's a basic answer to that question, kind of a high-level deal. All right, third one here, last one. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. Okay, this too is futility and striving after wind. Once it, you know, I already used the illustration. You know, the best barbecue is the plate of barbecue that's sitting in front of you. What you have is better than simply what you desire. Okay, I mean, there's utility to what you have. What you desire is just, it's out there. There's no utility in what you desire. Now, maybe if you obtain it, there would be utility, but there isn't any. And in fact, this is an impediment to enjoying what you have. It just really is, you know. I mean, you go out to eat with someone and the barbecue's dry. Don't let that ruin your conversation, okay? Don't let it, you know. You don't spend 30 minutes talking about how bad the barbecue is. It's like, who cares, right? You're with someone and, you know. You know, I don't know.
To take that a step further, that bad barbecue with a friend is better than the best barbecue alone at times.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, amen. I'd rather be, even if food's not great, if the conversation is.
Yeah, it's edifying, right? Right. There's nothing like more precious from a relationship standpoint than an edifying conversation where you walk away going, wow. It's not just that I learned something, but I think I might become a better person because of that conversation. That doesn't happen super often, but it does happen. And edifying conversations, right? Or maybe I was held accountable to something, right? Like maybe I had a bad idea in my head or bad action, and this conversation, you know, kind of helped correct me a little bit, right? I mean, those are you know, worth their weight in gold, those conversations. And the nature of the barbecue is immaterial, completely immaterial, right? So, in conclusion, and we'll finish here. The love of money, okay, is in fact vanity, right? A life filled with covetousness and greed is one filled with futility and striving after wind. All right, darkness, vexation, sickness, and anger, okay? The antidote is contentment, but it's contentment that's based on the belief in God's sovereignty and sovereign goodness. Practically speaking, you know, practice giving thanks to God for all things good in your life. So cultivate a life of thankfulness. And it's not just simply, you know, a thank offering. I talked about that, but it's other things. Just being thankful when something is good, when you have time with someone, you know, being thankful for it, right? You know, I thank my wife every time she cooks a meal, whether it's you know, good or not, you know. And it's not because I'm afraid of her, right? It's like I'm not afraid that she's going to jump my case and you know, like we have some signed contract that says say thank you or else, right? No, it's because I need to be thankful to be a healthy person. She needs to know that she's valued, right? For her to, you know, it helps her a lot in her own efforts, right? And so thankfulness, and whether it's in our own interpersonal relationships, one to another, or thankfulness to God for the goodness is something to cultivate. And we all have room to be better at. I know I do. My natural disposition is cynic, right? Actually, like that's my natural disposition is cynicism. And I mean, that was, you know, well, it's true, right? That's the excuse for the cynic, right? Is that, well, but it's true. It's like, well, okay, maybe it is true. But that doesn't mean, okay, that you can't find goodness in bad situations, because you can. The barbecue's bad? Sure, that's true. Fine. Okay? But does that trump your time with your loved one or your friend or your brother and your sister? I hope not, right? I hope not. It shouldn't. So let's not make, you know, and then I'm just preaching to myself here. You know, don't make excuses to be negative. And then lastly, receive all good things with joy. Okay? Receive all good things and with joy, always thankful to God for the time you have, the work you do, and the people in your life. So those are important things. Okay, don't fall off the cart, you know, as a hedonist, or don't fall off the cart as an ascetic. Okay, there are people like that, and you know, who refuse to be thankful to God for anything that's good, and the real reason is they want to take credit. All right. If you dig down deep, they want to take credit. All right. And it's not good. OK, receive things with joy, thankful to God for the time you have, the work you do, and the people in your life. Let's go ahead and close. Mike, would you mind closing us in prayer?